Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. David Smith has made teaching about world-mindedness and geography his mission. He's been a teacher for 25 years. He is the author of two wonderful books. The most recent is If America Were a Village, a book about the people of the United States. He's also author of If the World Were a Village, and has designed an award-winning curriculum, Mapping the World by Heart, a teaching program that helps young people learn physical and political geography. He's traveled all over the world and has presented his ideas about how to teach all of this all over the world as well. This, If America Were a Village, uses the same idea as if America Were a Village is the same as if the world were a village. It shrinks America to a village of 100 people, and it helps children and adults, I might add, easily understand American ethnic origins, religions, family profiles, occupations, wealth, belongings, a very interesting part of the book, and much more. David is joining us this hour of the program to talk about America as a village, and our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Hi, David. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, good morning, Kathleen.
So what made you think of this idea of being a village of 100? It's a great way to put all of this in perspective.
Well, the story actually goes back to when I was teaching seventh grade. In the mid-80s, one of my students asked me at the beginning of the school year whether he should take French or Spanish as his foreign language. Those were the two choices at that point. And he said, "Can you tell me which language is most important?" And I said, "I guess they're both very important. Can you be more specific about what you mean?" And he thought for a moment, and then he said, "Well, if our classroom were the world, how many of us would speak English? How many would speak French? How many would speak Spanish?"
Wow.
You know, the dime drops, as they say. And so we looked it up in the World Almanac, and he took Spanish, which is a much more widely spoken language than French. But at the same time, the idea for that, the little kernel of the idea was there. Reduce, at that time, it was under 6 billion, and it's now it's nearing 7 billion. The idea of reducing that vast and imponderable number to 100 was very attractive. I put together 40, 50, 60 pages, some of which are in the present If the World Were a Village, and some of which my editor and I decided were not too kid-friendly, like disease and landmines and wars and so on. But those, I still have those someplace, and there are a couple of publishers who are interested in, you know, maybe doing the dark side of the village sort of book. But anyway, the story begins there. 22 years ago.
It's just a great way to look at the world, not just for children, I think for adults as well.
It's a very easy metaphor for people to, you can get your brain around 100 people very, very simply. And otherwise, the numbers are just imponderable. I was at a school in Rochester, Minnesota, not too long ago, and they were trying to help children understand the concept just of 1 billion, and they started with 1 centimeter blocks, and they said, "How big would a billion of these be?" And they took 10 of them, and then 100 in a square, and then so on and so on and so on. And the final billion block, they actually constructed from wood lath and some green drapes over it. And it's, of course, it's 30 feet or more by 30 feet by 30 feet. It's a huge, absolutely gigantic cube that they built in the school gymnasium. And they said, and if this were the world, we would need 6.7 of these.
Do you think that, and I know you've got some historical facts in your book as well, that in terms of what you look at, population, ethnic makeup, you know, what we own, where we work, how much money we make, who's got most of the money, has there been a radical shift in this village of 100, say, in the past 100 years?
We're talking about the U.S. or the world or both?
The U.S.
U.S. Well, I think the really interesting changes to me as I put this manuscript together was about the way that people move. 100 years ago, we mostly lived in the country, farms and villages and so on. In 1900, 40 people lived in towns and cities, and 60 in the country. Though, of course, that's in the village of 100, or think of it as percentages. And today, over 80 people in the village of 100 live in towns and cities, and 20 live in the country. It's really dramatic.
It sure is. In terms of our ethnic makeup, Caucasian, Black, Asian, Native American, I think you put Hispanic in, Hispanic, Caucasian as well. Has that makeup changed? Are we seeing that we are much more what used to be minority population? Is that growing significantly?
Well, I think to me it seems less, the growth seems less rapid than I was expecting to see it. Although again, in the last 100 years, the change has been in where people come from. In 1900, 96% of the people who came to the U.S. came from Europe. And in the year 2000, 15% came from Europe. Half the people who came to the U.S. came from Latin America. And 31% came from Asia. In terms of the future, predictions by the Census Bureau and others, the numbers aren't all that dramatic.
Mm-hmm.
By 2050, the population is going to grow from today's 307 million to about 419 million, according to the Census Bureau, about one-third larger than today, in which there would be 72 Caucasians, including 24 Hispanics, 15 Blacks, 8 Asians, and 5 who identify themselves as members of other races. And that's not dramatically different from today, just a little bit.
What about 307 million people? Does that strike you, David, as a lot of people? Too many people for this country, about the right size?
We're treading on dangerous ground here.
I said it with a purpose. Yeah.
It's a lot of people. There's no question about it. And of course, we learn to cope. Those of us who live in cities and crowded places, we learn to cope by avoiding rush hour when we can, and that sort of thing, because of course crowds slow us down and complicate our lives. But there isn't much choice. I mean, I live in Vancouver, British Columbia. It's a city of 1.5 million people with 2 bridges, and so it's always a traffic jam.
Hmm. But you don't notice it because it's there on the ocean. It is so beautiful.
It is. It's a wonderful city. Yeah.
Yeah, it sure is. I was really struck by the statistics on what we own. If you would start with cars, please. We have a lot of cars.
We have more cars per person than anybody else. Let me just make sure I get these right. If our country were a village of 100 people, we'd have 81 cars. And if you look at the world as a village of 100 people, there would be 13 cars in the whole village.
Huh.
3 of those would be in the United States. So we have something approximating 25% of all the cars in the world.
Hmm.
But we're a huge country, and we are, you know, vast both north and south as well as east and west. Canada, 90% of the population lives within 100 miles of the southern border. And so there isn't so much driving northerly as there is east and west. And there's pretty good public transportation as well. So the need for lots and lots of vehicles may be a little bit reduced in that scale. And in smaller countries, of course in Europe, the infrastructure is really well developed for trains and getting around without a car. And I hear lots of interesting conversations about, you know, constructing high-speed trains in the U.S. and so on. And we may be on our way back to in that direction.
Hmm. What about televisions, radios, cell phones?
Well, if the U.S. were a village of 100 people, we'd have 74 televisions. If the world were a village of 100 people, there would be 25, and four of those would be in the U.S. Hmm. So, again, what is that? About just under 20% of the televisions in the world are in the U.S. So, yeah, we do own a lot of stuff, but, you know, it's part of our character. We like the stuff that we own, and we buy stuff, and we store it, and we use it when we can.
In terms of what we do, that was pretty interesting too. That how many of us are in sales? Even you break down those figures: education, lawyers, etc. What do we do?
Well, there are 18 of us in professions. Let's start with the fact that there are 47 who are employed. Now, I have to put in a comment here because the manuscript was finished before the great implosion of the economies of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so unemployment is, in if the U.S. were a village, is based at 5 rather than approaching 10 people in the village who want to work but can't find jobs. So I think that's a really important little footnote. And in the next edition of this, the next printing of this, we'll change that text a little. But 47 people are employed, and of these 18 are in professions, 12 are in sales, 7 are in service occupations, 5 work in construction and repair, and there are 5 people in manufacturing, farming, and transportation.
Hmm. And considering the changes that you just mentioned, how often do you have to update this?
Well, I haven't had to update if the U.S. yet. The first printing was large enough so that they haven't come back to me saying, what do we need to change for the next printing? But if the world were a village, we've had 18 printings since 2002, and I've had to revise it 6 times.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, some people find it really interesting. What are the things that are changing so fast in the world that you have to make those changes? And when I ask people to guess, often the guesses are religions, languages, and so on. But in fact, those are not changing substantially. The religions, number of Muslims has gone up by 1 in the world village of 100 in 9 years. But that's not one whole person. That's not 67 million people in the world. What it is a reflection of rounding. It went from just below 20 to just above, or just below 20.5 to just above 20.5. So I had to move it up from 20 to 21 Muslims in the world. But that was one change I had to make. Another change that's been really dramatic, just in 7 years, is telephones. In the first printing of this book, there were 14 telephones in the village of 100. And of course, what that means is 67 million equals 1. So 14 telephones means 14 times 67 million telephones.
Goodness.
In the world. As of today, we're up around 61, 62 telephones in the village.
Whew.
It's an amazing explosion. And of course, it's all cellular technology.
Right. And so is that spread more equitably?
That's the really important point, is that all over the world, there are places where nobody ever dreamed that they would have a telephone, where nobody would ever spend the money to put in wired telephones into homes, but where it's very economical to put up a cell tower and sell inexpensive handsets. And so there are whole micro businesses in the developing world, in India, in Asia, in most of South Asia, in Africa, where people buy a single handset and sell time to their friends.
Mm-hmm.
To make or receive phone calls. In fact, Paul Allen in the mid-90s gave a very famous speech, which he called The Digital Divide, and it was all about how, you know, the haves and the have-nots. And one of the sentences in there was that two-thirds of the people of the world live their entire lives and die without ever making or receiving a telephone call.
Oh, my.
And 14 years ago, that was true.
My.
But it's no longer true.
Goodness. goodness. Can you imagine what a different life it would be if you had never received a phone call? Mm-hmm. And the implications of that are quite profound, aren't they?
Very. Right. The ability to communicate with family members who've left to go somewhere else,
right,
for example, is such an important part of our lives.
And now our problem is communicating with family members. Get the cell phone off the kitchen table, right? It's quite a different
thing. Hang up and drive, right?
Yes. Please hang up and drive. That drives me crazy. Yeah. Tell me about this world-mindedness that's important to you in terms of how you try to get your students to think in terms of the world, and if that is something that we know when we teach geography, or is it a downfall of American education, particularly that we don't think about the world?
Oh, well, I wouldn't say that. We do think about the world in many ways, but I think it's less integral to a lot of what goes on in the U.S. than in other countries, and none of this. I'm really fearful that some of this sounds critical, but you know, I love the U.S. and I think that we could do better in teaching our children about global citizenry. But I don't think it's a huge missing piece. You know, what makes a good global citizen? Empathy, patience, curiosity, a sense of shared experience that we all sit down together at the same table.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I grew up in a family that was vitally interested in global issues. You know, my parents subscribed to at least 5 newspapers, and they read endlessly, and there were maps and atlases everywhere, and if something came up on, you know, John Cameron Swayze Presents the News, we'd go to the atlas and find out where the place was.
Hmm.
And for teachers and parents and librarians or anyone who wants to foster an interest in global issues in their children, there's an essay at the back of If the World Were a Village, and also at the back of If America Were a Village, that suggests some steps. Make sure there's some good up-to-date maps on the walls, not stored away, but visible, things you walk by and look at. Play geography games and ask geography questions. Connect children with others all over the world. Ask hard questions. Now, why is the world like this? Why are there so many people still hungry? Foster world-minded thoughts. And most important, make sure that children see that you love maps, that you're curious about the world and its people. Model the behavior that you want to see in your kids.
Where did you grow up, David?
In Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Oh, you did?
I did.
Oh, that's a good place to grow up. A lot of books and maps in that town, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Let's welcome phone calls for you. David Smith is our guest this hour. He was a teacher for many years. He's the author most recently of If America Were a Village, a book about the people of the United States, and also If the World Were a Village. He's also the author of the award-winning curriculum Mapping the World by Heart. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for David. Pat from Richland Center, our first caller. Hi, Pat.
Yeah, good morning.
Hello.
Good morning, Pat.
In your village of 100,
mm-hmm.
your village of 100 people in America, did
mm-hmm.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay, in this village of 100 people in America, if the economy, the total economy is $100, which would be like a dollar for each person if it was all split up even, could you give us a breakdown on what the income would be like for the top 5% and how much taxes it takes to run the show?
I don't know the answer to that second question, In the U.S. village of 100, 5 people have more than half of all the wealth.
Goodness.
The one wealthiest person, remember that one person represents 3 million people, the wealthiest 3 million people have 30% of all the wealth, and the 60 poorest share about 4% of the wealth.
And do you know what those people at the top are doing to make that wealth?
I don't. I don't. My guess would be, you know, some of it's earned, some of it's inherited, some of it's money that's been put to work. I honestly don't know.
And if you looked at those figures and compared those with other countries in the world, I would imagine the disparity in this country is quite a bit greater than it is in other countries. Is that right?
I honestly don't think so.
Really?
The phenomenally wealthy all over the world are phenomenally wealthy. There are billionaires in India, and in the richest 10 people in the world have in the World Village of 100 have over half of the money, and so the distribution of wealth, it's about the same in the world and in the U.S.
Thanks, Pat, for your call. We go to Judy next from Appleton. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. One, real quick, is that I just love this kind of research and this kind of work because it makes it so much more understandable to the layperson. And I have raised four wonderful daughters. And one of the things we've done in our home to foster this love of world and love of the nation is we kind of have a friendly competition between them, or they do, as to who's been to the most number of states. And I, of course, only allowed this game because I'd already been to all 50 states because that was a quirk I had. I wanted to get those last couple ones in. And then we also keep which continents, how many continents have you touched and stuff. And, you know, somebody listening might say, oh, well, that's a family with means. No, I'm a single mom. My kids are all scholarship children. They just happen to be smart. And I, you know, utilize financial aid where available. And so they've been to other countries on community service trips and have done and volunteered with language programs to go other places. But, you know, it's funny how they'll sit there and they'll say, oh, I got to change planes in North Dakota, so I get to count North Dakota because the rule is you have to touch the ground in that state. You just can't fly over it. So keep up the great work.
50 states you've gone to. Over how long did it take you to accomplish that, Judy?
I actually took a job. I was raised on a farm and graduated high school at 16, didn't want to go to college right away, and took a job with a program. Like, they have car shows that go city to city. Well, they have ski shows that go city to city. And I was raising money for the U.S. Olympic team, explaining why, you know, East Germany was... I'm dating myself, of course, because my kids tell me there's no East Germany. You know, why East Germany was funded differently than America and how we had to change that and support our, you know, ski team. And I don't ski. But, you know, I know how to raise money for nonprofits. And so by doing that job, there would be weeks where they'd say, well, United Airlines donated two tickets to such and such. Anybody want to work for that instead of cash this week? And I'm like, okay, I'll do that.
What a story.
That's a great story. Yeah.
Yes.
I think the idea of setting a goal like that for children is really useful. And it doesn't have to involve physical travel. The license plate game is something we always used to play when I was growing up. You know, you've got a list of states and you look for all the license plates that you go by, either when you're in the car or when you're walking, and you check them off. And you know, there's a prize or some sort of honor for whoever gets to the right number of the complete number of states first.
And did you grow up in Wisconsin? So you settled again back in the state?
No. I was born in Miami, and my family moved a lot when I was young. I only lived there for 10 days before I moved to the Northeast, and I've lived all over the world. So I myself am a gypsy, and it is. By going places physically, you know, you see the sign, it's 15 miles to the Vermont border or something like that. We would purposely go out of our way if we hadn't already gone to Vermont. And I think that's something that a lot of times people are just so in a hurry to get places and do things that the journey isn't really important. And it's kind of cool is that my girls have lived in the West, and they've lived, you know, they've seen the big open places, and they've lived in the desert, and they've been able to appreciate this. And the only rule they ever made up for me was I'm not allowed to live in the same place twice. because I sit there and I whine about, those used to be farms and now they're strip malls. So I'm not allowed to do that. But other than that, I'm allowed
to move
wherever
again,
I want.
What, the other thing that you said that I really admired was that that your kids are finding opportunities to travel in order to do service.
Right.
I doctoral dissertation on the impact of community service on students. Hmm. And I worked at Rutgers University is where I did my degrees, and I worked there because I got tuition remission. And so I could do all the way through without having to come out with student loans. And it was, there's so many opportunities available that people don't bother. They just sit there and say, oh, I can't go to college, or I can't do this, or I can't do that. And they don't look into it and try and investigate it. But Rutgers University is, at least at the time I was there, was 50% first-generation college, which meant most people were immigrants or children of immigrants. And so it was very important to know the difference between a Croatian and a Serb, and, you know, to know the differences in these things, so that you didn't make mistakes.
Right.
But they also were kind of militant about things by having part of the university was a women's college. You were not, if you ever sent a memo out and said, I needed volunteers to man a table at an orientation, all of them would come back to you circled in red saying, don't you mean staff a table?
Nothing like being aware. She makes a really good point. It seems obvious, but it's a good point, isn't it? To become aware, you have to go places and think about places beyond where you are or who you are, David.
Absolutely. It's so important to pay attention to what's going on in the world, whether it involves physical travel or reading or watching news on television or reading news in the newspaper or on the internet, just staying in touch with what's going on in the rest of the world. The National Geographic and the Roper organization do a periodic surveys of geographic literacy around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the developed world does pretty well, and the U.S. has not done as well compared to most of the other developed nations. And one of the things that they set out last time was to find out why questions like what country borders the U.S. on the south aren't answered as accurately by U.S. citizens as by citizens in other places. One of the things, they went back to all of the people that did really well on these surveys, and one of the things that they found out was that the ability to speak more than one language directly related to scoring well on these geographic literacy quizzes. And the other thing was having visited other countries.
Mm-hmm. Very important. Thanks.
Both of those are important.
Thanks, Judy. We go to June from Shawano. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. I'm enjoying this program very much, particularly how you use math and to create knowledge among adults and children, whether it be in geography or any field. And I was particularly taken with your idea of dividing things up and using both centimeters and yards and things like that. Particularly, I found I used to tutor students in math, and I always tried to tell them, look at the answer. Does it make sense? I mean, yeah, they can proceed through, you know, and do all the things right and come up with an answer that has no reality given the question. And I did that with my son, too, when I was helping him. But our gas man stopped by the other day, and he said, you know, if you're going to change from propane to LP to natural gas, you can only transport a tank with 10% of gas in it. And he said, and you're not there yet. You have 11%. And I said, but it's a $300 gallon tank. And he looked at me strangely. Huh. And of course, 30%, it would be 30 gallons. But thank you for what you're doing. It's wonderful.
Well, June, thank you so much. I'm really glad you mentioned the word math, too, because it reminds me that how many teachers and homeschool moms and dads have looked at these materials and said, aha, we can do some graphing with this. or we can work on fractions or percentages with this. So math is such an integral part of what I do, and it's such an important piece of our ability to understand the rest of the world.
How religious are we?
In the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. And in the world.
Well, in the world, the numbers are quite different. If the world were a village of 100 people, there'd be 32 Christians and 21 Muslims, 13 Hindus, 11 who practice folk religion, 6 Buddhists, and 1 Jewish person, and a total of 17 who either practice other global religions or who are non-religious. In the U.S., in the world, 32 Christians, in the U.S., 82 who report themselves as Christians when they do their census, 54 Protestants, 24 Roman Catholics, 2 Mormons, and 2 practice other Christian religions. There are 2 Buddhists. There are more Buddhists than Jews or Muslims in the U.S. One person is Jewish, one person who's Muslim, 4 who practice a wide variety of other world religions, such as Baha'i, Sikhism, and so on,
mm-hmm.
and 10 who consider themselves non-religious.
Hmm.
So, and the interesting thing is that 82 consider themselves Christians. There's 2 Buddhists, there's 1 Jew, 1 Muslim, but only 40 people in the village attend a religious service regularly.
Only 40%? Huh.
Mm-hmm.
And what about the figure of 10 being non-religious? Was that surprising to you, David?
I was expecting it to be larger, frankly.
Really?
Church attendance is down in all over the world, but in the U.S. and in Canada. And I thought more people would consider themselves non-religious, would report themselves non-religious. And yet the connection to a heritage, a religious heritage, is very important for many people.
Mm-hmm. And I've always, I have heard, maybe this isn't true, that when you look at us compared to particularly European countries, even though it may be 40% go to church one day a week, that if you looked at European countries particularly, the figure would be much lower?
Honestly, I don't know. I haven't done that. But I have the same expectation. If I... I expect that if I sat down and did those numbers, it would probably look like that, that fewer people attend religious services in other parts of the world,
mm-hmm.
Or at least in the Western world.
How do you decide when you come up with a list? I mean, it seems pretty comprehensive here in terms of you get a good understanding of what the village is. But how do you decide what will be included to make up a village?
Well, it's a very... what's the word? It's not a clear cut decision. There are so many possible topics and so many ways of incorporating information. And the origin of if the U.S. were a village basically is that as I traveled around to schools talking about if the world were a village, I was often asked, "Well, what about the U.S. or what about Canada? What about France?" And so I did the work on the U.S., put together a handout, and my editor and I looked at that and said, okay, we could make this into another book that people would be really interested in. And the decision about what to include meant leaving out lots of really interesting stuff. So I guess it's still a work in progress. Later editions will probably look different.
Let's go to Louis from Wausau. Hi, Louis.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
I've done a lot of research and collecting of data on religion in the last, 20 years. And there are good, solid numbers corroborated by several projects. An accounting firm, for example, 45% of us say we go to religious services regularly.
Mm-hmm.
By actual measurement, about 20% of us actually do. And the same numbers go for what people give, pledge to churches.
People.
And then when you get into less, more amorphous, if that's the word, less solid numbers about why people go to church and whether they really understand anything about the religion. Maybe, you know, Stephen Prothero's book, it gets way down from that. So my comment is we are not as religious as we think we are or that we say we are. And I wonder if you have any...
And why do you think we say we are, Louis?
I have some information, at least with a couple of people, and on extended interviews, and people say they are more religious than they are because, well, you might say the quick answer, it's the right answer, or it supports my church. And the person who never goes there but wants to support it, or who doesn't go there very often.
Interesting.
And one clergyman bemoaned this, accepting the numbers, by saying, well, we are not as forthcoming as we might be in our admitting to our religious practices. And another person, a little more blunt, said, well, we lie about our religious practices.
Well, the U.S. Census Bureau collects the data. But then there are, as you say, there are a number of really interesting organizations that crunch the data, do further interviews, and try to figure out how all of that data actually plays itself out. And I've read in some sources, as you say, that even though about 40 people in our village of 100 say they attend a religious service, only about half that many do. But I didn't have any data, concrete data, to support that from an organization that I felt comfortable citing. And so I didn't include that, but I did include the Census Bureau data that says 40 people attend a religious service every week.
Thanks very much for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. David Smith is our guest this hour. He taught school for some 25 years. He is the author of If America Were a Village, a book about the people of the United States. And he looks at the United States in terms of a village of 100 and then looks at, you know, what our ethnic backgrounds are, what we do for a living, who's got the money, what we own, where we came from, a lot of that information. And he's also author of If the World Were a Village and is the author of the curriculum Mapping the World by Heart. We have a couple lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. The email address, talk@WPR.org, is also available to you. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go back to phone calls. Laura is next from Whitewater. Hi, Laura.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Morning, Laura.
I'm good. This is a really interesting topic. I'm going to go out and buy the books now because I'm very interested in this. It's amazing. I've never really thought about putting it in the village of 100, but I really like the concept.
It does make it really easy to understand some very complicated issues.
Right. And I was wondering, my question was, in your research, did you ever find out how many people in the village of 100 would be gay or lesbian? Because I know I've heard 10% or 1 in 10, but I didn't know if you actually went out and did the research. And I'd be curious, the United States versus the world as a whole.
Well, here the problem is that nobody collects that data. The U.S. Census Bureau doesn't say, you know, what is your sexual orientation? There is no great national either NGO or governmental organization that collects that data in a reliable way, and so you have to depend on sources that may or may not be biased. The one thing I was able to discern in if the U.S. were a village is that about 1% of all families. That doesn't mean one person in the village, but 1% of all families in America are made up of two people of the same sex, either two men or two women. And some of these same-sex couples have children.
Yeah, so I was just curious. But, yeah, because I've always heard the magic number is 10% or 1 in 10 are GLBT, but I never really I didn't know if the research was out there, but it does make sense that that data has just not been collected yet. But.
I've seen that same number, and I can't find, for myself, to satisfy myself, a source to validate it.
Mm-hmm. You do look at, and I would imagine there have been changes here. Tell me how substantial they are in terms of the makeup of family. How many two parents, how many one parent, how many families without children?
Well, when people think of an American family, you know, they often imagine a mom and a dad and two kids. But in reality, American families come in all shapes and sizes, as I say in the book. 20 families have two parents, while 7 are single-parent families. And that's 27 families. About half of those families have children under the age of 18. There are 10 households in the U.S. Census Bureau database. 10 of our households are made up of just one person who lives alone. And then there are a number of people who live in households of two or more unrelated people sharing living quarters. And I imagine that has changed over time, just in terms of family shape and size. It's not so long ago, 50, 60, 70 years, when Warden June Cleaver really were what most of America looked like.
And now a lot of America can't remember who they were.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You're a lot younger.
One of the demographic things that's really interesting to me is how people orient themselves around the country. Half the population lives in just 9 states. California, by far the largest, 12 out of the 100 people in our U.S. village live in California. But 9 states, the remaining 50 people live in 41 states. And North Dakota was mentioned earlier. I guess it was Judy. She mentioned changing planes in North Dakota or something, but Wyoming, Vermont, North Dakota, Alaska, and South Dakota all together add up to just one person in our village of 100.
Say that again? What are the how many states?
Five states.
The
five least populated states account for just one person in our village.
Huh. Life would be so different if you lived in that kind of place, wouldn't it?
It would be. Less crowded, for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure. Thanks, Laura, for your call. Rick from Manitowoc. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier about the percentage of the wealth is like 5% of the 100 in the village have like most of the wealth. Do you have that broken down into for income tax? What percentage of the people do pay no income tax in that village, and how much is burdened on the wealthy people that you have?
That's a really important question, and I couldn't find a dependable, valid source to support any data about that. What is tracked by our government and by the NGOs is how personal wealth is distributed, not by how they're taxed. There is data out there, but it's really cumbersome and it's really hard to make sense out of it. But personal wealth, gross assets, there are 47,000 people, roughly, in this country who have 20 million or more, for a total of about $2.7 billion.
Wow.
And the one wealthiest person, as I said, which represents 3 million folks, has more than 30% of all the wealth. The people in our village who live below the poverty line, that is, make less money than is required to meet food, shelter, and clothing needs, actually has been increasing. In 2000, there were 11 people living below the poverty line. In 2004, 12. In 2008, it was 14.
That's
broken down by middle class, perhaps? How many people would be considered being in the middle class in the village?
Well, again, you get into the question of, okay, how... this has been a really interesting topic of conversation because of where Obama draws the line at 250,000. Is that really the dividing line between middle class and upper class, for argument's sake? It's a nebulous line. What is middle class? And so I haven't included in this book, which is primarily a book for children, but it certainly is a conversation that we need to be having. Hmm. You're absolutely right.
14 people at poverty level or below is a significant number, I would think, in this country particularly.
It's an important number, yeah. Yeah. In the U.S., the GDP per person is about 46,000. Worldwide, it's just 10,000. So that makes us about the ninth richest country in the world.
Mm-hmm. This is a figure that really struck me. I was wondering what everybody does for a living. Delaware having the highest average income, and this is per person. I think most people will be astounded to hear it's $70,000.
Mm. Yeah, it's just an amazing figure.
Yeah,
and I imagine a lot of that is inherited wealth that generates income. But honestly, I didn't break that down. I mean, the shocking thing to me is that there's still such a huge difference between men's and women's incomes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for every dollar a man earns, a woman earns 77 cents.
That should have been taken care of a long time ago.
Yeah, it seemed that people tried hard to take care of it, and I guess we're still moving in the right direction.
Thanks for the call, Rick. Slattery is next from Maribel. Hi, Slattery.
Yes, good morning. The conversation that you're presently having, I did research a couple of years ago on this. That data is very clearly delineated. If you, like, Google IRS income distribution, you can find who pays taxes, what the income is by, you know, filing of 1040s, and it's by $5,000 increment. And when I was doing my study, what was amazing to me was roughly 30% of the people earning income in this country pay no taxes because their income levels are so low. The other thing that struck me being involved in farming is over 70% of all farmers, and you can find that on this IRS data, it's on Excel spreadsheets, 70% of the farmers involved in farming are operating in the red. So farming is definitely not a profitable business. The other thing that struck me was that the top 10% in this country are earning over the past 25 years, their net after-tax real take-home income increased by something like 81%, while the bottom quintile grouping increased by only 5.9%. And if you look at the top 1%, it's 181% is their net increase. So
their increase over time.
Data you might
That's very important information. And part of the decision I had to make is, okay, this really is a book aimed at elementary school, primary school kids. It's a picture book for children. And so the conversation about the complexities of income taxes and so on is difficult. But, yeah, there is data. The IRS collects the data. The last year that I could find was 4 or 5 years ago, though, where they had crunched all the data and made it available. It may be more recent now because I haven't really looked for it for a few months. So I haven't really wanted to cite data that wasn't as current as I could possibly get it.
What's your next project? What's the next book? Do you know?
I finished the manuscript. It's a picture book for kids about the rights of children based on the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child.
Hmm.
I got permission from UNICEF to use it, to revise it according to my own needs, as to make it more kid-friendly. The manuscript's done, the illustrator has it, and it's going to be called This Child, Every Child.
Hmm. And it will be distributed around the world, David?
Absolutely the same way as these other two books have been.
Yeah. And tell me about your travels. You do, is it mostly your curriculum that you're...
I haven't traveled purely for fun in 15 years.
Oh, my.
I travel for work. I travel to conferences and to schools. Next week, I've got a couple of book events on the East Coast. In January, a literacy conference in Ohio and an in-service for New York City teachers. February, at an ALA conference, a Library Association conference, March, working at some colleges in the southeast, and then a conference in Tallinn, Estonia.
Oh, my.
And so it's that kind of travel.
Right.
I'm lucky. I'm the luckiest seventh grade teacher that ever lived.
Yeah. Thanks so much for being with us. David Smith, our guest, and he's taught seventh grade for 25 years. The book we most recently published and the emphasis of our conversation this hour, If America Were a Village, a book about the people of the United States. He's also author of If the World Were a Village, and he is a man who put together a curriculum mapping the world by heart. And you can find out more about that by going to mapping.com, teaching program helping students learn physical and political geography. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Jalema Noel for producing this program. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for all of your calls and for listening, everybody. Great conversation ahead, so stay right where you are. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.